Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com. Welcome, everyone. My guest today is Managing Editor James Kleiman to talk about the federal regulatory activity we're seeing in both real estate and mortgage from the Department of Justice and the CFPB. As always, I want to thank our podcast sponsor, Vesta, for making this episode possible. James, welcome back to the podcast.
I feel like it's been forever.
I know, it has been forever. And meanwhile, we have so much news. So the news I'd like to talk about today is just we're seeing this sort of like unleash of the DOJ being unleashed on, you know, when it comes to these commission lawsuit settlements. So would love to get your take on that.
Yeah, this is a big one. So it's pretty common knowledge, I think, that the DOJ has been interested in the commission lawsuits, and this stems back years at this point. They had an existing settlement agreement under the Trump administration. I want to say it was November of 2020, and they were looking at two separate rules of NAR. One is the what we call the participation rule, which was the main rule that the commission lawsuits had targeted. And the other was the clear cooperation rule, which essentially requires any realtor that begins any marketing of any home to list it on the MLS within 24 hours or the next business day. And so a lot of agents will get it on a Friday and they won't list it until Monday. Anyway, the DOJ under the Biden administration appealed the settlement. The Biden administration did not like the settlement that the Trump administration had reached with NAR and said, we want to continue our investigation into NAR and its practices. And about a week ago, by a 2-to-1 vote, an appeals court in Washington, D.C. agreed with the DOJ, and now they are free to reinvestigate NAR and any policies that it sees fit. And so that opens up a lot of possibilities, and I think it casts a pretty large shadow over the civil settlement agreement reached between the plaintiffs in Sitzer Burnett in Missouri and the NAR and various brokerage companies as well. So we now start to look at a very different calculation. And so I think the judge in the Sitzer Burnett case has been waiting on what happens with the appeal. And the DOJ, although they've put out some statements saying that they want to see large-scale changes made to realtor practices, they haven't lodged any official appeal. They haven't been anything more than an interested party in the case. So what happens next, most likely, is that the DOJ is going to issue a statement of interest in the Sitzer Burnett case, and they are probably going to do one of a number of things. Here are some of the main things they could take issue with. And the first one is, I think, the biggest, so we'll start there. One of the key tenets of the settlement agreement is that although commissions are somewhat dislocated in that you can't have it on the MLS, a seller's agent can't say, hey, we're going to be offering the agent who procures the buyer 2.5% or 3% or whatever that number ends up being, that is no longer allowed in the MLS. However, there is a pretty massive carve-out. And that carve out is you can put it anywhere else. So if an agent wants to have their own website, if they want to put it on their brokerage website, if they want to put up an etch-a-sketch at the open house that says we're going to pay buyer agents, you know, 2.5%, or you know, and there are other, I think, similar forms that this could take, and that really these just become classified as concessions. These are seller concessions. And you really don't have to worry about it. And effectively, many of the practices that are 70, 80 plus years in the making will continue to be the standard, right? The practice. So that's the major thing. The DOJ has made it very clear in no uncertain terms that they want to see a full dislocation of cooperative compensation. They do not want the sell side agent to be dictating the terms of the compensation for the buy side agent and the buyer, right? Ergo the buyer, in any way, shape, or form. And so the DOJ may very well say, hey, Judge Stephen Bowe, we appreciate all the hard work that's gone into this case. We don't feel that this rule is appropriate or satisfies what we consider to be an antitrust violation. So that's the first major one. Now, the judge could ignore the DOJ. The judge could say, these are the terms of the settlement. Here's my interpretation of the law. And these two parties got together and said, this is fair. This is equitable. The plaintiffs are receiving $418 million over a period of a couple years. And that satisfies all parties involved. And although the DOJ is an interested party, they're not party to the suit, right? It's a separate matter. And so that's one possibility. The judge could, as is often the case, look at this and say, you know, the DOJ has obviously a pretty big role in policing antitrust practices. And so maybe that gives me a little bit more time, and maybe I will take the recommendation and not certify the settlement and ask the two parties to come together and, you know, make major changes to that agreement. That is another possibility. The DOJ could also say, this largely satisfies what we were looking for. However, we don't like the $418 million settlement. We don't think that's a big enough number, given all the harm that was done to consumers over the course of, I mean, this is a fairly narrow suit, but, you know, if we really want to kick some dirt around, we can say that number should be much, much, much bigger, right? A jury already determined that this was at least $1.8 billion, and with treble damages, we're at about $5.3 billion, and you're getting off for $400 million. That doesn't even really seriously damage, you know, the institution that, in the eyes of the jury, has maintained these illegal practices for years, right? So that's another component. There is one final wrinkle that I think we should talk about. I don't think it's particularly likely to happen, but the DOJ could pursue a criminal case against NAR, against members, executives of the NAR. They could say that these are violations of criminal statutes, and this is more than just a civil case because you have violated antitrust, right? That's not something that, in most cases, you know, regulators casually say, oh, okay, well, you know, that was in the past, we move on, right? It's a whole other kettle of fish. So I don't think that's very likely, but the DOJ absolutely has a lot of cards that they could show here now that they no longer have to wonder about what happens with the appeal.
So there's, I mean, this is why it's such a big deal, right? Because, you know, here we had, you know, we had this agreement that they reached, and it's like, okay, at least that's, you know, maybe it's not great, but, you know, it's a line in the sand, we can go forward. And now it feels like we've just threw everything back into, you know, a situation where we have no idea what this is going to look like again.
We don't. And this appeals process, not appeals process, but, you know, all of the related components were always going to take a little while. I think most people, myself included, were surprised at how quickly the settlement between NAR and the plaintiffs and Sitzer Burnett came together. I thought, even if it's just a negotiating tactic, that NAR would say that we're going to drag our feet, we're going to appeal it to, you know, to the highest court, and that they would really fight this for much longer than they ended up fighting it. Now, they did it without the really knowledge or approval of their largest member organizations, right? The carve out from the settlement with the Sitzer Burnett plaintiffs is pretty massive. It's $2 billion in sales volume in 2022. And that's about roughly 100 of the biggest brokerages that did not get included. So they might even want to seek other terms. I know that they're negotiating their own terms, but it's not like everyone was unanimous in that this was a good deal. I think most people felt that it was a good deal for NAR, in that suddenly they're no longer under threat of becoming extinct, right? I think given all of their properties, all of the money that they have from membership, they have their own technology firms that they own. They have a licensing agreement with Realtor.com. They have quite a bit of money here and there, but maybe not operationally, but they could liquidate and they could figure out a way to pay a $418 million judgment, no problem. You get into the 1.8 something billion, you get into the 5 billion, and as well capitalized as they are, the Realtors Association does not have that kind of money. So it's a good deal for NAR. I don't know how many people would disagree with that. I don't think many. But is it a good deal for the everyday realtor? Is it a good deal for the managing broker? Is it a good deal for the CEO of a publicly traded brokerage? I think that's a little bit of a different question.
Boy, I do too. And to your point, it's like the DOJ can come back and be like, okay, we think you owe more, but it's like, at what point does it become an existential threat to NAR? Like, how much money do they have?
So last we've been able to officially glean, they had about $1 billion in assets and cash as of last year. Could they pay a bond of $1.8 billion if that were, you know, that's not going to be the number. I think that would be the bridge between that and 420-ish million is too significant, but maybe the DOJ wants to raise it just a couple hundred million. I think they might have to sell a couple companies. They might have to sell some of their own real estate if they needed to get there. I don't think that NAR has $600 million in cash. Now, keep in mind, the settlement also doesn't have it paid up front, right? They're paying, I think, about half of it within, you know, about a year. And then the rest of it is staggered over 5 years. So they certainly have $200 million that they would be able to come up with. But I don't think that we're in a place anymore where we're wondering if the NAR even survives this kind of litigation or even the threat of the Department of Justice. The threat of the Department of Justice in the aggregate is much bigger than any of these civil cases. And we still don't know how that will end up being, you know, adjudicated, if at all.
Man, so we have the DOJ on one side. In a whole different realm, we have the CFPB. Sort of reactivated, right? So we've seen a lot of action by the CFPB lately on the mortgage front. Tell us what's going on there.
What isn't going on there? The CFPB is such an enigma to me, and that's partly by design, right? And they're regulators, and they don't exactly telegraph their moves. They don't typically share with the media what they're up to, what their priorities are, what they're focused on. We do know from supervisory highlights and various reports and congressional hearings from Rohit Chopra, the head of the CFPB, generally what their priorities appear to be. But every now and then something comes out and you go, what? That? What? Why? What are you guys up to? What's the deal? And the most recent couple are kind of interesting and especially interesting for the everyday mortgage practitioner. The CFPB has made a lot of noise lately about discount points. So when rates are low and the margins for the mortgage company are much fatter, discount points aren't utilized nearly as often because your monthly payment, it doesn't make a lot of financial sense for you to drop from, say, 2.5 to 2.3% because your every your monthly payment would be a difference of like $18. So like why pay, you know, X amount to buy the points up front when it doesn't really meaningfully change your financial position in terms of liquidity on a monthly basis? Now, when you're staring at a rate of 7.2, 7.3, which is where we're at about now, it's Thursday, April 11th, as we have this conversation. If you want to buy a full point, it's going to cost you a lot up front. It's going to cost you several thousand dollars to buy out that from the mortgage lender. You're basically paying up front to reduce the monthly payment over the course of 30 years, right? And the CFPB's interpretation is that there are a lot of lenders who are goading or convincing people to buy all these points up front, knowing that they're going to try to refi them in, you know, fairly short order, and that financially it's not always the best decision, that it makes more sense to hold on to it longer, to let it amortize before, you know, it makes sense to refinance your mortgage. What the CFPB, I think, analysis misses is they didn't really take into account the LLPA changes that the FHFA had put forth about a year ago. Those were pretty significant. And they also, they don't analyze credit scores. And we come back to the same problem across so many of the studies. Like, do you remember, gosh, it must have been about 6 months ago, there was this big CNN investigation into Navy Federal and how they're not lending to Black people, and that their practices perhaps were discriminatory or at minimum not inclusive. And this was specifically pertaining to Black veterans. But again, you know, that analysis didn't look at credit score. It didn't look into a lot of factors that I think that the people I talk to in the industry say are really critical for getting a complete picture of someone's profile, really their risk profile. And I don't know the ins and outs of the Navy Federal investigation or whether there really were, you know, I think problems with their credit reporting process, or maybe the underwriting was too strict across certain areas than others, or that certain people that have, you know, protected characteristics or are in a protected class were, you know, misidentified or, you know, not given the opportunities that they should have been by the letter of the law. But if you don't have the credit score, if you don't have the full picture of that person's finances, it's hard to say that that person has been, you know, the victim of some sort of injustice here, right? It doesn't mean that it didn't take place. It very well could be the case that they didn't do it correctly. I don't know. And the fact that the CFPB also doesn't have the credit score, that they're not able to put that data into use, is, it's difficult to really understand if they get it, if they're right about it. And this is a bigger problem, right? And I think that the aggregated credit score should be in the HMDA data. I think that people should have access to that. I don't think the credit score in and of itself is going to be, you know, an indicator. I don't think it's going to be enough for someone to gleam, oh, like that was Bob Smith at 123 Main Street. And because we don't have that really important information, we don't really know if people are not following the best practices and really lending to people who need the help. And it's no secret that the credit box, in my opinion, is too narrow, and that the lenders are, not even just the lenders, right? The GSEs are a little too conservative with who they're willing to lend to. And that trickles down. This doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's not like Navy Federal woke up one day and said, oh, you know what? We just don't want to do any more mortgage originations. So let's just make sure that we're only doing 50 today, right? It's just not a proper accounting of how the industry functions or how they process risk. So all of that is to say, Sarah, that they're going after these discount points that I don't think they fully captured the full picture of. I know a lot of attorneys in the regulatory space feel similarly. I know a lot of executives in mortgage share similar sentiments. That doesn't mean we're right, but at least from our interpretation of what the CFPB looked at and their statements, I don't think that they got the whole thing. The other thing that they're looking into, and this is a major, major, major one, is title. And we've seen the CFPB, we've seen the Biden administration through other government-owned companies take a look at title, really scrutinize the value. And the Biden administration is kind of nibbling away at the edges and saying, okay, homeownership is way too expensive. Housing is just unaffordable, right? We know that there are a lot of problems. We know that there are a lot of middlemen and women. Let's be fair. There are women in this too, getting their 1%, 2%. And cumulatively, it has the effect of increasing the cost for a consumer by 10, 15, 20%, right? You add the 5%, 6% for the agent. You add the mortgage, the origination fee, all of the other, you know, fees that go in it. When you add the title, you add the appraisal, and suddenly you're like, wait a second, I'm paying like $50,000 in fees. Like, is this necessary? Is it protecting the integrity of the property and the risk of those who are underwriting it and collateralizing it? And so the CFPB is looking at this problem and saying, okay, look, if you're the lender, why is the borrower paying for your risk? Why are you, even if it is disclosed, even if the borrower is aware that you're making them pay for the title that protects the lender and not even explicitly them, why is that their problem? Why can't they get that $1,400 or $1,500 back and, you know, do whatever it is they need to do with it? Maybe they need to repair something. Maybe they just need a little bit more liquidity cushion, right? So that's what they're doing. The CFPB believes that the responsibility of ensuring that the title is clear and the cost that should be borne should not be on the borrower, but on the lender itself. And from the lender's perspective, they're looking at this and saying, hold on, I've lost money on every single loan I've done for 7 straight quarters, almost certain to be 8, right? I don't think there's anyone in the mortgage industry who really thinks that anyone's going to be rebounding in the next quarter, right? And so I would be looking at, what, another $1,200 conservatively in losses if you add title to my cost. So what the lender would probably do, and for the record, no one has told me, James, I'm a lender. I'm lender A, and if this happens to me, here's what I'm going to do. But here's what I think that they would do. They would either bake it into the rate. And so, okay, you know, I'm lender A, and now I have this additional regulatory cost of, say, $1,200. So, hey, funny coincidence, that mortgage just got $1,200 more expensive, right? My origination fee just got a little bit fatter, right? So they cannot bear the cost. These companies would not exist if you added this cost onto them in a, and were very clear that you couldn't pass it on to the consumer. So that's the first thing to consider. The second thing is, okay, let's say the CFPB does wind up doing this. It is both purchases and refis, and it would come into effect next year. It, by the way, this preliminary plan that the CFPB is apparently hatching, first reported by Bloomberg, really good scoop by them. This would not go into effect until 2025. It is still early stages. I think it's very possible, very likely even, that they walk some of it back or all of it. They've already done that with Fannie Mae having a title pilot. And so, okay, the other big question that immediately comes to my mind is, let's say the CFPB does go through with this. It's both purchase and refi, and the CFPB figures out a way, statutorily speaking, to prevent the lender from trying to claw back that cost of title insurance. So let's say it's about, you know, it's usually what, like 0.5, 0.6% of the loan, 50 basis points. So we're going to say, give or take $1,500, right? Now we look at the dynamic. Okay, so lender is going to be buying this because they have to protect themselves, because that mortgage is worth zero, right? If they don't have clear title, right? And they'd spend more on just litigation than anything if there were an issue. So they're still going to have to get title insurance in some form. Suddenly, don't they have a lot of leverage over the title insurer? If you're a UWM or a Rocket, or I mean, Rocket has their own title insurance company. But if you're one of these big lenders and you're going to be buying 100,000 policies, like, you think they're going to cost $1,500? Absolutely not. And let's be real, title insurance, the risk is not very high. We're talking payouts of like 2-3%. We had a comment on one of our stories the other day from a real estate veteran who's worked for like 45 years. And he's like, in all of my time, I've literally never seen a claim that got paid out. Like, I've never seen it. I've personally seen a couple of them. But like, we're not talking about an industry that pays out like normal insurance does at 50, 60, 70% rates, right? So you know, maybe the risk really isn't that high and they can negotiate the cost of it, which is almost all in commissions anyway, right? It's labor costs, it's commission costs. Maybe that can be $400. Maybe that's the cost of the appraisal, right? Appraisal got flattened.
I mean, there's lots of people who are like, why is the buyer paying for the lender's title insurance? I mean, we've all had that question. But it's also interesting that it all comes down to they're trying to make it more affordable for the consumer. But as you said, as we all know, if you're asking the lenders to eat that, first of all, they're already losing money. Second of all, they're going to find another way to bake it in, because it's like, how can you ask them to take on more? You know, now it's instead of like $11,000, now it's going to cost $13,000 to do every loan.
Right. Or they completely flip it and say, Fannie and Freddie are cool with us going a different direction. Maybe we don't need proper title and everything. Maybe we will do the, you know, attorney opinion letters. Maybe we will look at, you know, alternative programs. Maybe this will be, you know, in conjunction with the bigger Fannie pilot, in which they say, hey, like this only pays at 2%. Like Fannie has more than enough money, you know, if it really comes down to it, right? So, you know, and it's not exactly like without precedent that a government would be willing to bear the risk and cost of title. The state of Iowa has its own chartered title company after they literally banned private title insurance in 1947, and it works pretty well. So, you know, I know obviously it's a lot more complicated when you look at just how big this country is and how many levels and layers of government bureaucracy. And like, you know, when I bought a house in Pennsylvania, it's like, you have to like physically walk into this dusty office full of like asbestos tile ceilings. And, you know, you have to find like, you know, these records and these old filing cabinets, and like nothing was digitized. There is no national property registry. That would be something cool. Maybe the Biden administration could spend $2 billion and digitize every single property record in this country. And if they really do want to eliminate this cost for homeowners, create a much better system, digitize everything, and go from there, right? But I think right now the bigger problem is, yes, title insurance costs $1,500 or so. I'm just throwing a number on there. Appraisals, another $600 or so, right? And then you have the real estate agent fees, and that's another, let's say, argument's sake, $10,000, right, in cost, just minimum, much closer to 20, right? And so you add all this together, like that's real money. That is absolutely real money. And I don't think it's wrong for the Biden administration or any administration to scrutinize our housing markets and say, at the end of the day, maybe this isn't really something the customer needs at that level. Maybe, you know, they don't need the full appraiser walkthrough. Maybe they don't need a full policy on title, especially if they bought it from a builder, or, you know, like it was clear last year and then the seller just signs an affidavit saying nothing changed and that's it, right? Like, we don't have to have this system that has kind of calcified over the course of 100 years. Like, there are, you know, other ways to think about it. But the real problem is we haven't built enough housing in this country. We have too many easy reasons for people to say no and to block it. We have too much litigation. We have too many environmental rules. We have too many mortgage regulations, full stop. I mean, way, way, way too many. You could probably save 100 basis points if you simplified mortgage regulations and just stop with, like, you know, this urge, this desire to look at every single thing under the hood and overly complicate it. So that's my take on it. But, you know, I don't think in a vacuum it's a bad thing to look at title or appraisal or, you know, any of these things that they're doing.
Interesting that, you know, we're having this rash of squatters coming in and being like, no, I own this. You know, I'm the rightful person. This actually just happened to my niece here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. She, you know, they gave her the, she's renting something. She went over there and there were people there. So she called, you know, called the management company. She's like, okay, well, are those people supposed to be there? And they weren't. They were squatters that had just moved in. So now they've got to try to get them out. And we're seeing this. I mean, it's just this crazy problem. But I think about when you talk about having, you know, I wonder if Iowa has less of that because there is an easy way to figure out who actually owns the property, you know?
I don't know. That's a really good question. So my own politics aside, America is so full of crazy people and it is so easy to get a weapon. I would never, ever, ever in a million years do that. Not because, you know, oh, it's expensive or you need to get a lawyer or there's this or you deal with the sheriff's office. There are too many insane people with guns in this country that like, I don't want to die because like, I didn't want to pay rent that month. You know, like that's my perspective on this. So
I know. Yeah. Well, and you just think about the fact that there's that guy in California that the property managers pay him to go in and move in with the squatters and
saw that.
And whatever he, no one's sure what he does, but they move out within a day. And I was like, I mean, again, a very risky proposition, though, right? You know?
Yeah. Like we don't know what he's doing. And I imagine it is, you know, we know it's coercive, but we don't know exactly what he's doing.
There.
So yeah, it could be pretty dark actually. I don't know about that one.
It's so crazy. Well, James, thank you so much. What's clear is that, you know, we definitely have that federal intervention, different levels, whether it's the DOJ, whether it's the CFPB. I do have to wonder, you know, how much of this is because it's an election year. We know that, you know, yep. The Biden administration feels a lot of pressure to do something about housing, to fix housing or the housing crisis. And they've been doing this for a couple of years, right? Like you said, you know, they're looking at appraisals, they're looking at title, they're trying to cut the costs around the edges, but it'll be interesting to see. Thanks for being on and telling us all the things that we might be looking at.
Cool. Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to take a minute to rate the show or leave a comment. We'll see you back here on Monday for more news and insight.